Hello. Welcome to Locally Grown. Locally Grown is an audio magazine focusing on ideas, issues, events, and discussion produced for WBCR by Housatonic Radio Works. Be prepared for a timely, topical show today. We have four segments for you. First, we talk to Mark Fischetti. 4 years ago, Mark wrote an article for Scientific American that described a scenario very like the one we've been experiencing in New Orleans this past week. We also have a conversation with Joe Carter, a Stockbridge resident who's living with HIV. We talk about his experiences living with the virus and living in the Berkshires. There's a fundraising walk being sponsored by the Red Cross this week on Saturday for people with HIV/AIDS. It's going to be held in Pittsfield. Joe tells us how to get involved. Andy Carvin, the director of the Digital Divide Network, spoke with us this week about the causes and impacts of technology access disparities, both here in the U.S. and in the developing world. We finished the program today with Bob Balow, reading one of his signature obituaries at this month's performance of Words Out Loud. Please enjoy the show. Mark Fischetti is a veteran science writer and editor for numerous national publications. He writes and edits primarily for science, technology, and business publications. He is contributing editor for Scientific American and has written for Smithsonian, The New York Times, Science, Omni, MIT's Technology Review, Forbes, and Sports Illustrated. He lives in Lenox and works in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. In October 2001, Mark published an article, The Drowning of New Orleans, in Scientific American. In this article, he laid out a scenario of a Category 4 or 5 hurricane striking in or near New Orleans, leaving the city under 20 feet of water. He also called attention to the increased risk of catastrophe caused by the impact of human activities along the Mississippi River and the steps that would be needed to mitigate these risks. Mark graciously agreed to speak with us after a grueling schedule of recent media appearances. We began by talking a little about that Cassandra effect. How does it feel to receive this national attention in the face of a disaster, the possibility of which he drew attention to 4 years earlier?
I would just assume none of this attention were being paid to me, but which means the disaster wouldn't have happened, but it happened. So, you know, I guess we got to, after the obvious first priority of taking care of people, we got to try to learn something from all this. So that's kind of the spirit in which I'm trying to talk.
We talked about the article, Drowning of New Orleans. What first drew his attention to the potential fate of New Orleans and its environs, and how did he come to write about it?
Yeah, I was just looking into science about hurricanes in general, and I was reading something about Louisiana State University. They have a hurricane center there, and they do a lot of computer modeling of storms, and I was reading descriptions of some of their work, and there was a line in there that basically said, you know, if a Category 5 hurricane crossed the Gulf from the southwest and hit New Orleans, that the entire city would be under 20 feet of water. And it just sort of stopped me for a second. I realized, you know, 20 feet of water in a major city doesn't sound too good. So I contacted them, and one thing led to another. Essentially, they've modeled hundreds of paths of hurricanes, different size hurricanes, and a number of the models, Category 4s and Category 5s, coming up from the south would impart lots of damage to New Orleans. So that led to the article, which basically discussed the possibilities of what would happen, and then it went on to talk about, well, you know, what could be done to protect the city, and that got us into wetlands and deltas and levees and all the things we're hearing about now. So the article basically came out and said, look, you know, if this kind of storm comes, it's going to be an awful disaster. And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened.
New Orleans and the Mississippi River have been environmental works in progress for well over 100 years now. A lot of events of the last several days have their roots in the extensive work that has been aimed at controlling the river all along its length, and particularly in its delta.
Well, it's sort of a gradual thing. And a lot of people are asking now, you know, should New Orleans be where it is? You know, why is the city built there? You know, this, all of this, the city, the levees, all developed over a long period of time. You know, it was the mouth of a major river, so of course people are going to settle there. And the Army Corps of Engineers has been building levees along the Mississippi River since before 1900. So the real short explanation is once the entire Mississippi was levied in, you know, the river naturally floods every spring. In flooding, it brings sediment and fresh water to the delta, and it builds up the land that gets worn away from regular ocean waves and all. So that has not happened for long periods of time. And because of that, New Orleans is sinking because it's not getting that new sediment, and the marsh below it, which protects it from hurricanes naturally, is dying away because it's not getting that revitalization every spring. The bad irony is that now, in the situation that we're in, the only way to protect New Orleans is doing more of what put it in peril in the first place. I mean, you can't, even with the city being destroyed, I don't think it's realistic to expect that no one's going to try to bring it back. Of course, you want to try to rebuild the city, but it doesn't make much sense to rebuild the city without simultaneously improving the protection all around the city. So, you know, if there's a plan, it's got to include some of these major projects that would protect the city.
Ironically, there is a plan that was put forward many years ago that was called for a massive mitigation strategy with the hope of heading off the type of disaster that New Orleans is suffering today.
Yeah, it's called Coast 2050. This is my article in Scientific American came out in October of 2001, and the sort of second half of it, which talks about how to protect the city, is based on a plan called Coast 2050, which was released in 1998. That was a number of scientists and engineers and Louisiana State officials who all got together and basically agreed on what the handful of major projects should be that would protect the city and the whole Delta, for that matter. And then there are other minor projects in addition to that. And they published this whole set of projects in a plan called Coast 2050. That was 1998. Then, you know, state senators from Louisiana went to Washington. I mean, the cost estimate, if all the projects were done in that plan, was about $14 billion. So that's a lot of money. So the state went to Washington and said, hey, you know, we need help with this. And Washington basically just turned a deaf ear. They just didn't give it much due, and so the plan kind of sat there. So that's the sad thing too here, is that there was certainly a plan. How much of that would have been in place by now? Probably a fair amount of the local, you know, the local levees and things. Some of the projects certainly could have been done by now. Certainly would have spared some people's lives at least. And that's sort of a tough thing for everybody who knows about that plan to just sort of know that it's that there.
$14 billion to implement Coast 2050. The same cost as the Big Dig in Boston.
Yeah, that's what's more. Now that I've been on all these networks lately, you know, I've been on typically with other people, and you learn a lot from each other. And you know, someone drew that parallel this morning on the press. You know, $14 billion. That's pretty much exactly what the Big Dig was. I wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times on Friday and brought up the point there that in 2000. The Florida Everglades project, Congress was approved that project, and it was essentially a $7 billion project to revitalize the Everglades in Florida. And it's very similar kinds of work. You know, it's more fresh water into the marshes to reconstitute them, redirection of water flow. It's very similar to what would need to be done in some parts of the Mississippi Delta. So the price tag, even though $14 billion is a lot, as you point out yourself, you know, it's not unheard of for public works projects. It's a matter of whether there's a will to do it, not whether they can find the money.
The first sentence of Mark's 2001 article reads, "The boxes are stacked 8 feet high and line the walls of the large windowless room. Inside them are new body bags, 10,000 in all." We talked about how prepared New Orleans was to face this onslaught, a risk that science told them was highly probable.
it's one thing to have plans, and they, you know, there were even models. There are even models of get right down to the what would the traffic flow be out of there. But the emergency response, everybody's trying to figure out who to blame, and I think there has to be a shared response. There's certainly shared responsibility, and if you want to say that, then there's shared blame too. But the city and the state and the federal government all could have done more. And starting from, there was this mandatory evacuation order that went out across the city. Well, you know, it's one thing to tell everybody they have to leave, but there, as we've heard, you know, there are 100,000 people, more than that, who cannot leave the city. Not just that they don't have a car, they don't have any money at all. So how are they going to get out of a city? They can't, they don't have a dollar to pay bus fare, and there weren't buses anyway. So you have to, the city has to provide a way for people to get out, which in that case would have been, you know, buses and buses and buses, and the state has got where those buses go. They have to go somewhere, so the state's got to provide that. And, you know, in terms of a disaster after it happens, when it's that large of a thing, it's well beyond the city or state, so the federal government's got to come in. So they, you know, they all share some responsibilities that they probably didn't carry out the way they should have.
And Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert recently took political heat for suggesting that the rebuilding of New Orleans didn't make sense considering the continuing risk it faces from hurricanes and water as time goes by. What is the future of New Orleans, and how does the city recover from this disaster?
Yeah, you know, whether they should or not. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's the automatic reaction is we got to rebuild. And, you know, that's kind of the American spirit, and I would agree with that as well. But as, you know, as I was saying, if you're going to rebuild, you have to improve the protection of the city at the same time. So to just sort of clean up buildings and start, you know, rebuilding them is maybe a little unrealistic, because, you know, again, you're putting people right back in that situation. But, you know, even if that's done, even if the protection's improved, I think one thing that people aren't realizing is that, you know, what New Orleans is known for most, I suppose, is, you know, there's this music, there's this whole artist community, there's every corner you turn, there's live music, there's this, you know, roots music everywhere, and, you know, all the musicians who play all that music all year long, everywhere across New Orleans and the Delta, and all the people who cook all these local meals and local joints all around the place. You know, that all exists in part because all those people are able to live right there. Meaning, you know, you can find a place to live for $200 a month. You can find an apartment to live in that's affordable, and all that's been wiped out. I mean, you can't just, most of these buildings, if you can clean them up effectively, are structurally going to be compromised. So, unfortunately, if you rebuild, the cost of rebuilding is never going to allow a $100 a month apartment. So, it's going to cost much more to live anyplace in a rebuilt new building than it would have cost there before. So, I really wonder if that kind of culture can even exist in a rebuilt city. It will certainly be different than it. You know, these are real people with real lives. They're neighbors. They're your neighbors. They're our neighbors. We got to help these people. But yeah, a lot of those people are no income or low income, and even the people who have, you know, reasonable income, if they go back to the city, there's no jobs there. So there's not going to be any work to be had unless, you know, you're going to qualify somehow in the rebuilding work. But it's a lot more complicated than and socially much more disruptive than I think people are thinking about. I mean, let's start from the beginning. You can't rebuild anything until you've got a power system in place. Well, you can't. This is how it has to go. First, you got to build roads. So that you can build power systems. And once you have power systems, then you have to build sewer systems. Then you can start to build houses and any other buildings. Only then. So you're talking a year to get basic infrastructure in there, and perhaps even longer, because, in part, there's nowhere for those workers to live while they're doing this work. this is a you know, it's a disaster zone of huge proportion. So any kind of work for a long time is going to have to be done in a kind of, you know, how work camps are formed when you're doing something in a remote area. You got to cart workers in for 8 days on and 4 days off, or 2 weeks on and a week off, whatever the schedules are. And they have to live somewhere else, and someone has to pay for them to live somewhere else and transport them back and forth. That's how all this has got to get started. It's very, very time-consuming, costly, and complicated. So all the people who have been forced to leave are not going to have something to come back to for a long time as it is. And then when they're back there, you know, the jobs they had are certainly not there anymore, if they had at all.
Mark Fischetti, veteran science writer and editor, and author of an article that appeared in the October 2001 edition of Scientific American called The Drowning of New Orleans. Mark spoke to us from his home in Lenox, Massachusetts. You are listening to Locally Grown.
My name is Joe Carter. I, with the Consumer Advisory Board, which meets under the Red Cross, it's for people who are living with HIV and AIDS. This coming Saturday, we're planning on having a walk, not only to memorialize those whom we have lost to the disease, but to give recognition to the people who are living with it. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who do not understand that the fact that we have life-saving drugs doesn't necessarily mean that the quality of life has improved for those who are living with HIV and AIDS. To begin with, some of these people are resistant to the drugs that are available, and the drugs are very expensive. Not only that, they come with a variety of side effects that make them very, very difficult to take with some people. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, you're talking about the human cost, because so many family lives are shattered when a loved one develops a disease. Some people are separated from their families, some are shunned, and basically the attitude of the public in general is they don't care. It's not something that's visible. You don't know who has AIDS or who's living with it or whatever. It's not something, a catastrophe unlike the Hurricane Katrina in the Gulf, where you see human misery, but it happens. There are untold stories, and most of the people who are living with the disease are not out about it. You know, they don't talk about it. It's something that they keep hidden for a variety of reasons, be it their jobs or their family or their friends or whatever. And I think that's probably the biggest tragedy of this disease, is there's so much stigma still attached to it. Even after 25 years of dealing with it, it's still with us. Unfortunately, there's a great deal of complacency around it also, where a lot of people think, oh, okay, well, you know, we have these drugs, and you know, you may get the disease, and you can take a drug that'll keep you alive. Unfortunately, it has done nothing to eliminate the existence of the disease, and people are still dying from it.
And the now, in terms of the Berkshires, this is, the walk is being sponsored by the Red Cross locally.
It's co-sponsored by the Red Cross and the Berkshire AIDS Coalition. It's basically a fundraiser. Over the years, especially in the past couple of years, state and federal funding for people living with HIV and AIDS has diminished, almost to the point now where if you were to develop the disease, in certain instances, you might be put on a waiting list for drugs, which is absolutely absurd. because you don't have 6 months to wait. So in part, this is to raise funds to supplement some of the programs that they run at the Red Cross, and to give financial assistance, direct financial assistance to some people who are having a hard time, because this is a life-changing situation. I mean, I myself, I'm still working, but I can't work like I used to. I don't have the energy I used to have, and there are, you know, periodic issues that come up relating to health that
How do the health insurance programs cover these kinds of drugs?
Well, if you were insured prior to the time that you were diagnosed, then chances are they can't touch your insurance. For people who have no insurance, they can apply for MassHealth. But again, the system is strained. And again, you're talking about paying co-pays, and a lot of these people, because they're so financially tapped out, it's very difficult for them to meet their financial obligations as well as live. Unfortunately, in Berkshire County, up until recently, and well, even to straight through to today, it's a problem that people don't realize exists. It's one of those things that people don't talk about, or it's not a topic of conversation, but it exists. It's just like any place in this country, we have problems, and AIDS is one of them. And unfortunately, in this part of the state, we have the highest incidence of intravenous drug users and women becoming infected. And most people don't know that.
Really?
They still see this as a gay disease, and a disease, and it's not that at all. It's like spreading like wildfire in minority communities, mainly because of drug use, I would imagine. And add to that, you have a new drug which is sweeping in popularity, methamphetamines, which lowers your inhibitions and then makes it more likely to put you at risk to catch the disease because you don't care. And this is one of the focuses that I have when I talk to young people. You've got to be educated as to what you're doing. You know, I don't advocate any particular type of prevention. Just be aware, be knowledgeable. And this is one thing we're trying to get people to be, is, you know, be aware and be knowledgeable. There's such a vast amount of ignorance out here. Even in the town that I live, even among my friends, I mean, the first thing they'll say to me, and I'm sure they mean well, you're taking drugs, right? And they're doing all right. Yes, I'm taking drugs, and my life is going, you know, fairly well. But, you know, it's not an answer. There are no long-term studies as to what these drugs are going to do to me in 10 years from now. There's no long-term study that suggests that I will not develop a resistance to these drugs. And because I'm over 50 years old, I'm now dealing with issues that older people normally deal with, such as diabetes and high blood pressure and arthritis. Whether or not they are age-related or whether or not they're accentuated by the fact that I have no immune system, they don't know. So, you know, there are a lot of unknowns, but the sad fact is a lot of people just don't want to know, and that in part is the purpose of the walk.
Now, the walk is scheduled for this Saturday.
This Saturday at the Berkshire Commons at 11
that's,
o'clock.
That's Saturday the, I'm sorry, Saturday
September
the
10th.
And it's at the Pittsfield Commons, you said?
The Berkshire Commons in Pittsford, right? It's also, you know, I mean, I'm kind of romantic about it in that I'd like to see that see us build something along the lines of a community instead of being, you know, like separate towns and this, that, and the other. The only way we're going to fight any disease, be it drugs or AIDS or teenage pregnancy, is if we all get together and come up with a common solution. And in this case, by coming together as a community, it'll make it a lot easier for people who are living with the disease and hiding.
And how do people, where should people call to sign up?
The Red Cross. They can call Pat Wood at the Red Cross.
All right. In Pittsburgh. And so basically, how long is the walk?
Basically 2 hours. It's supposed to be a 6K walk, but, you know, I'm sure some people will take shortcuts and whatnot. The way we raise money is to have our walkers collect funds.
Okay. And, Joe, do you have a sense of how much money locally the Red Cross is spending to assist folks with HIV, living with HIV and AIDS, in their medical care?
No, not really. Okay. See, it's not just medical care. They provide services such as funds to get to and from medical care. There's a food assistance program. There's over-the-counter programs. There are all kinds of programs that they support. The only thing that the state does not fund, unfortunately, is prevention and education.
Mm-hmm.
And to my mind, that's something that we really need more of, because there are a lot of people who just don't, they have no idea that it even exists, much less, you know, what it's about. And word really needs to get out. I mean, from time to time, I try to speak in high schools to kids. They're very receptive to it because, you know, it's messages that they get from MTV and VH1 about getting tested, but they don't know why, you know. I mean, no one is explaining to them what happens to you when you get HIV, what happens to you when you become infected. It's not something that it can be cured. It's not something that you can go to mom and dad and cry about. It's a life-changing experience.
Sure. Well, I want to thank you for spending this time with us today, and I want to thank you for the work you do and wish you good luck.
Thank you very much, and thank you
sure
for
enough.
Calling.
Thanks. Bye now.
All right. Bye-bye now.
Joe Carter spoke to us from his home in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. You're listening to Locally Grown on WBCRLP 97.7 FM in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Andy Carvin is program director at the EDC Center for Media and Community, where he runs the Digital Divide Network, an online community for activists working to bridge the digital divide. He's the author of the pioneering online education resource EdWeb, Exploring Technology and School Reform, named by NetGuide magazine as one of the top 50 places to go online. EdWeb was one of the first websites to advocate the use of the World Wide Web in education. Andy is also the founder and moderator of www.edu, the Internet's oldest and largest email forum on the role of the web in education, and Digital Divide, the Internet's premier discussion group for digital divide issues. We recently had a conversation about some of the issues that he's involved in here in the United States and in the developing world, particularly Africa. You've been involved in doing internet stuff really from the get-go.
Yeah, since 94 was when I first started doing it seriously. I've been using bulletin boards and email and other resources since probably like 1984. So more than half my life at this point. But it was really once I graduated from grad school in 94 that this became my full-time gig.
Mm-hmm. Well, I noticed that I was reading your biography or a biography, and I saw that you were the founder and moderator of www.edu. I was right in that period. I subscribed. Yeah.
Really? Oh, that's funny. Funny how people intersected time and space.
So I was reading that. I was like, oh yeah, I remember that.
Right. Yeah.
So right now you bring it right to the future. You're program director at the Center of Media and Community in Newton, Massachusetts. Can you tell us what the center does?
Sure. Well, first, I should just probably step back a bit. We're part of a larger institution called EDC, or Education Development Center, which is one of the largest nonprofit institutes in the U.S. focusing on education reform, education policy, and education technology. It's been around for almost 5 decades now, and it's made up of a group of individual institutes that have different focuses on various issues. And originally, the work I was doing with the Digital Divide Network was at the Benton Foundation in Washington, D.C., and we were there for about 5 years. But then the Benton family decided to change its programmatic focus of the foundation, and so the president of the Benton Foundation, Andrea Taylor, and I, we essentially took all of our digital divide-related resources and intellectual property and merged them with EDC to create a whole new institute called the Center for Media and Community. And the goal of this was to create an institute within EDC that would focus specifically on the growth of the Internet and the knowledge society and how that impacts marginalized communities, whether it's low-income communities, people of color, developing countries, people with limited literacies, and really trying to understand what are these gaps that exist between people when it comes to either having Internet access and not having it, or having certain skills and not having them, and how does that impact people educationally, socially, culturally, politically. And so the main project we've been doing and continue to do is our Digital Divide Network online community. But at the same time, we've worked in other areas as well. We've done a lot of research on equity issues regarding e-government, making sure that as governments deploy online services that they take into account the digital divide and take into account challenges faced by people with disabilities and other marginalized groups. And we've done a variety of other activities and events related to community technology and the role of the Internet in global development.
Now, it seems like there's a lot of assumptions that that are made in terms of, well, we've posted that online, we have that information is out there, that service is being provided electronically or online. Can you identify some of those assumptions and how they impact some of the communities that you work with?
Sure. Well, I mean, a great example is if you look at what's going on in a massive emergency like a hurricane. Last year, I spent a lot of time observing how the Florida state government was handling its deployment of information and resources regarding the hurricane evacuation services and things of that nature. And when you'd watch government officials on TV, they were always very good about making sure that there was a translation in Spanish, sign language for people who needed signing, etc. But then when you'd go to the state government's website and take a look at what resources were available, what you would see was, in general, a lot of these emergency notifications were being published in PDF. And PDF formats are great for those of us who are able to use them, but unfortunately they're not accessible to many people with disabilities. There are lots of accessibility challenges in terms of just having screen reading software and other assistive technologies being able to translate the information of a PDF file into something a person who is visually impaired can access. And so on the one hand, the state government was clearly thinking strategically about the use of TV, media, radio, and other traditional media for reaching marginalized communities, but the use of the Internet wasn't as well thought out. And so even though they were producing lots of important resources, because they were only slapping them online in PDF format, meant that only a certain segment of the online population would have access to
it. Yeah, that's a good example. And also there's economic issues.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. And if you look at the data on the digital divide as I've been crammed across the U.S. Department of Commerce, what you see is there's what you see is there's a correlation between the income
When we look at the statistics, there's even a greater correlation for the digital divide when you look at education. So for households that have at least one person who've spent some time in college, even if they don't have a degree, as long as they've spent some time in college, there's an extraordinarily high likelihood of them having internet access. But when you compare that to a household in which family members don't have their high school degree, you're looking at only about only 15% of those households having internet access. And so income is a factor, but I think education is an even bigger factor.
Which, in many cases, goes back to income again.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are lots of interrelating factors here, no doubt. It's just that the numbers are appeared a bit more stark when you look at it purely from level of educational attainment. Mm-hmm. And so it's always important when talking about policies to bridge the digital divide, we have to go beyond simply talking about the affordability of internet access and the affordability of computers, even though those are both two very important issues. But as long as we have major educational challenges in this country, such as more than 20% of the U.S. adult population is functionally illiterate, they may know how to read and write, but they struggle to apply it in day-to-day situations. And you could give them free broadband internet access at home, but you can't expect them to know what to do with it or be able to use it effectively as long as they're functionally illiterate. And there are many other challenges regarding language, for whether or not families speak English as their first language, challenges accessing content for people with various disabilities. And so Al Gore used to say that when you talk about the digital divide, it's really the ABCs. It's access, it's basic skills, and it's content. And there's still certainly some truth to that.
And then looking at, you know, one of the communities that you mentioned earlier was developing nations. And how does that play out when, I mean, does it play out writ large when you talk about a...
Yeah, well, there's one statistic that tends to get cited a lot, and I don't know how accurate it is anymore, but basically it went something like this, that there are more people in Manhattan with internet access than there are in all of Africa. And from what I understand, that number, that stat isn't totally accurate, but you could still probably fit all of the people in Africa who do have internet access into the five boroughs, if not Manhattan itself. So when you look at places that are still developing, parts of the South, such as sub-Saharan Africa, parts of South Asia and Southeast Asia, and even parts of Latin America as well, there is just a yawning gap that exists between developing nations and their internet access and developed nations, particularly when you start comparing them to places like the U.S. and Canada, Scandinavian countries, some of the East Asian countries, particularly Korea and Japan. The gap is quite striking. But it's more than just whether or not there's a lot of internet access in each of these countries. Again, there are challenges related to literacy, to freedom of speech, whether or not telecommunications providers have been privatized or if it's still nationalized. And if there isn't competition, chances are dial-up connections are so expensive, they end up being more expensive than what we would pay for broadband here. There's also a general lack of localized content in local languages. And so while those of us who are living in North America or Western Europe or East Asia, it may seem like we've progressed really far in terms of having internet penetrate our entire society, there are countless countries all over the world where it's barely even scratched the surface.
Now, you just recently returned from Africa, correct?
Yeah, I was in Ghana for a part of July. I'm currently working on a book taking a look at what are called telecenters, which are these community technology institutions, places like libraries and school computing centers, YMCAs and Boys and Girls Clubs here in the U.S. There are parallel institutions like that in every corner of the globe that are offering public internet services as well as
IT training and basic education training, content creation services, and things of that nature. And so in this book that I'm writing, we're going to be profiling telecenter initiatives in different parts of the world. And so I went to Ghana mainly to take a look at two different projects that were going on there. One, a very successful cyber cafe in the capital of Accra, which even though it's an entrepreneurial business model, it's very socially conscious and community oriented, and is doing important work in helping local small businesses go online and develop certain skills they didn't have before, and training youth to use these technologies. And then in contrast to that, I then went to visit a small village about 3 hours north of Accra, a village called Patrienza, and they have a small telecenter there that's operated on solar power, and they offer very intensive IT training courses that last up to 9 months. And the goal is to introduce village youth to a very serious level of understanding of computing, to the point that they can go on to get a variety of certifications for networking certifications, computer repair certifications, and in the hopes of them developing small businesses and helping build the local economy by creating a homegrown IT sector and or publishing multimedia content.
Now, one of the facts about Africa that I'm interested in is, and the developing world in general, is the lack of landlines and actually having cellular technology in place before telephone landlines. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, absolutely. There have been reports that have come out in recent months that show that Africa is the fastest growing mobile phone market on the planet. The number of mobile phones have far outpaced landlines in Africa. It's been that way for a while. But it's mobile phones are growing faster there than they are here in the U.S., which is quite extraordinary. I think it's just a matter of time before African mobile phone providers and content developers start figuring out creative ways of using mobile phones as a major way of accessing the internet. And so in the same way that I can use my Handspring Trio mobile phone, or people use their BlackBerries to check email, that mobile phones in Africa will hopefully soon have somewhat affordable data services. It may take some time, but it's heading in that direction. But having said that, I'm also a little leery when I hear policymakers and others get so excited about the mobile phone revolution in Africa and say, well, then we don't have to worry about Africa's digital divide because eventually everyone in Africa is going to have internet access over their phones and we don't have to worry about anything else. And while it may be true that more and more people in Africa will be accessing internet over their phones, it doesn't necessarily mean that we should write off bridging the digital divide in Africa in terms of improving computer access, particularly in the home and in community centers, and giving people computer skills. Because, you know, if you think about it, even though I can access email and do various other things on my phone, if you took my computer and my laptop away from me and forced me to only use my telephone for all of my internet needs, I would go crazy probably in a matter of hours, especially as a content producer. Because, you know, my andycarvin.com blog, I'm producing stuff there almost on a daily basis, if not multiple times a day. And even though I'm pretty good with those little thumb keyboards on a mobile phone, my thumbs are going to fall off in a matter of hours probably. And so even though that's somewhat of a silly example, it does go to show you that simply assuming that mobile phone internet access will solve Africa's development needs just seems somewhat naive to me, and that instead we need to approach this and talk about different technologies and their applicability to different development needs. And so in some cases, so for example, farmers who are working in very rural environments who need to get the latest crop data before they bring their crops to market, using a mobile phone-like device or a PDA makes a lot of sense. But when you're in other environments, whether it's a rural villages,
any kind of a community gathering area, like a public health institution or a school, or larger urban environments, having computers connected to wireless or satellite or what have you, are going to be very important for addressing development needs, as are other more conventional tools such as community radio, community television, ham radio, and the list goes on, even things as simple as fax machines. And so it's I think we can be really excited about what's going on with mobile phones in Africa, but we can't see them as a magic bullet either.
Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us. Andy Carvin spoke to us from his home in Lowell, Massachusetts. He is the director of the Digital Divide Network. Andy travels the world and is very interested in blogging, audio blogging, and other forms of digital technology. And I thought it would be interesting to share with you some audio blogs from his latest trip, which was a visit to Ghana. And at one point, he used his cell phone to blog a car breakdown.
Hi everyone, Andy Carvin here. Right now I am in southern Ghana, somewhere on the road between Kumasi and Accra. Our car just broke down. I think we're probably about three quarters of the way to Accra, but you wouldn't know it because we're in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, even though it's only 7 p.m. here, it is pitch black outside. I can see thousands of stars. Full view of the Southern Cross right now, directly ahead of me. Otherwise, I'm quite this is an extremely dangerous road, and we're all standing out here on the side of the road with the hazards flashing, trying to figure out what on earth to do next. So hopefully we'll be able to sort this out soon. So here's our good luck, I suppose. And so if this ends up getting posted, that must mean we must have solved it. Until next time, this is Andy Carvin, posting a mobile podcast from somewhere north of Accra, Ghana, in West Africa. Hi, everyone. Andy Carvin here. It's 9 p.m. somewhere north of Accra, Ghana. We've managed to travel maybe another 30 or 40 kilometers. A feed truck stopped by and put a tow bar to the front of our car and managed to drag us whatever number of kilometers that was, and the tow bar ripped off and the truck drove away, and we fortunately got left behind right by a gas station with a bunch of Ghanaian soldiers here. So we pushed the car out of the highway, and amazingly the feed truck came back, so it turned around and they're currently trying to connect it again, and we've got a group of around half a dozen people offering their expert expertise on how to properly connect the feed bar without it ripping on the highway. Now, supposedly, we are only 5 miles away from our destination, but, you know, I'll believe it when we get there. I'm just kind of in a zen-like state here, just not worrying about how long it's going to take. My goal is as long as I'm in bed by midnight, I will consider this a successful evening. I have 3 hours to travel this mysterious 5 miles. So until next time, this is Andy Carvin reporting from a Ghanaian gas station on the Kumasi to Accra Road.
Hi everyone, welcome to another Ghana edition of Andy Carvin's Waste of Bandwidth. It's Friday, July 22nd at approximately noon here in Accra, Ghana. I've been here for about 5 days now and it's been a really productive week. I'm actually back at the busy Internet Cyber Cafe for the third time this week. Spent a lot of time here earlier on Monday and Tuesday interviewing people, talking to customers and staff, taking advantage of their blazingly fast internet access to catch up with emails back home. And then on Wednesday and Thursday, I had a few other really interesting opportunities. In particular, on Wednesday, first I got to do a blogging workshop over at Ghana Telecom's training headquarters, and then spent the afternoon at the Buduburum Liberian refugee camp about an hour outside of town. If you've been following my blog, you had a chance to read some of that. And it was quite an extraordinary experience. While I was there, I had the chance to
Spend a lot of time meeting people, interviewing people, and shooting a lot of videos. So I'm hoping sometime within the next week or so, I'll be able to post a short documentary, probably a 5 or 10 minute documentary, about the experience. In the meantime, I'm able to upload some short videos. Given the bandwidth limitations here, I can only post so much at a time, so I'm doing short clips for now. But stay tuned for more videos later. Then yesterday, I got to a tour of the Kofi Annan Center for Excellence in ICT, which is a state-of-the-art technology training center here in Accra. And then later that day, had another blogging workshop with a group of journalists, academics, and other people for about 4 hours in the afternoon. They didn't have the best internet access there, and we didn't have a projector, so the situation was somewhat limiting, but in a way it was actually kind of useful because the internet was so slow. It forced us to figure out strategies for compressing audio and video in such a way that we could upload them in a way that would be reasonable for the typical Ghanaian with typical internet access here, which is usually not close to broadband, or at least in the way that we would understand broadband back at home in the U.S. So today I'm catching up on emails for a couple of hours, and then after lunch I'm going to head out towards Kumasi and the village of Petrinza to visit its telecenter for the weekend. I'm going to be there with Dr. Osei Darpa, who is one of my hosts here this week, and I'm hopefully going to have some time to play tourist as well, visiting the town of Kumasi, which is the capital of the Ashanti Kingdom. Sites in that area, and then back towards Accra on Monday. So that's basically it for now. The only other thing I would mention is, as you probably noticed while listening to this, that I have some music playing. That's the Ghanaian artist Obo Adi, who was introduced to me a few months ago by Mark Grimes over at the Omidyar Network website. I contacted Obo Adi's record label and asked if I could use some of his music in my podcasts and videos during this week, and they were gracious enough to say yes, with the one caveat that I acknowledge them for doing that and offering a link back to them on my website. So you'll be seeing that when you go take a look at my site. So once again, thanks to Obo Adi and his record label for letting me use the music. So until next time, this is Andy Carvin reporting from Accra, Ghana. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Locally Grown. Bob Balo hosts a monthly performance series, Words Out Loud. Words Out Loud takes place in Housatonic, Massachusetts, at Deb Kaufman Studio on Front Street. It is a performance series of music and spoken word, prose, and poetry. It's on the first Thursday of each month, and our microphones were present when Words Out Loud took place on Thursday, September 1st. Bob Balo performs one of his signature obituaries.
Hey, welcome aboard. This is Words Out Loud. And what a beautiful night. How lucky we are to have such nice weather when other people are suffering because of the weather. Regrettably, I have to read an obituary. I know that that's not really the way to bring up everybody's spirits at one of these gatherings, but somebody has to do the dirty work. So this is tonight's obituary. Yolanda Yalta Yeltsin, 54, died after many years of telling lies. Only last week, both her primary care physician and her Freudian psychotherapist warned her that she was approaching her personal lifetime limit of 93,500 lies. But she continued telling cock and bull stories with no regard for her health. Yolanda Yalta Yeltsin figured she could fudge her way through another decade or two, since she came from good Russian stock, like her uncle Boris Yeltsin. But in fact, she was not even remotely related to the former Russian president. Her real ancestors actually came from Panama and went by the name of Balboa. Yolanda Yolta Yeltsin adopted the surname Yeltsin to honor the memory of a burly truck driver, Bubba Yeltsin, who gave her a ride when she was hitchhiking on the New Jersey Turnpike. Until that ride, she never knew there was so much legroom in the cab of a tractor trailer. Of all of the tens of thousands of lies told by Yolanda Yolta Yeltsin over the span of her dubious life, her biggest whopper was that she played one of the Oompa Loompas in the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. She earned a sizable amount of undeclared income pretending to be a minor movie star, posing for pictures with little children and signing autographs. She marketed herself as an Oompa Loompa at carnivals, shopping malls, street fairs, children's birthday parties, gambling casinos, and truck stops. And people were all too happy to give her money for a quick brush with celebrity. However, Yolanda Yolta Yeltsin was caught in her scam by none other than Gene Wilder himself, the star of Willy Wonka, who has remained in close contact with his fellow actors. Upon discovering the gross misrepresentation, Wilder declared, "I know the Oompa Loompas, and Yolanda Yolta Yeltsin is no Oompa Loompa." The last lie uttered by Yolanda Yolta Yeltsin, the one that pushed her beyond her 93,500 lifetime lie limit and transformed her from liar to fatality, was her false claim to her landlord that the check was in the mail. Yolanda Yolta Yeltsin, dead at 54. She was a Red Sox fan.
You have been listening to Locally Grown. Locally Grown is an audio magazine produced exclusively for WBCRLP in Great Barrington. Opinions expressed on this program belong to those that express them, and not necessarily to members or programmers at WBCR. Questions, comments, or suggestions for this program can be addressed by email to locally_grown@mac.com. That is locally_grown@mac.com. You can contact this station at 644-9797. That number again, 644-9797. Or by email at info@berkshireradio.org. That email address again, info@berkshireradio.org. Thank you for listening to our program. Bye.